Over the next couple of years, when I would articulate something that I needed to do or somebody I needed to meet, through mysterious means that person would be introduced to me, within hours, frequently. I will never forget the time that I said, "We really need to get this information to the Secretary General of the United Nations." And within about an hour or two someone called who I had never heard of and said, "You don't know who I am, but I am very good friends with Boutros, Ghali and Mrs. Boutros. Ghali, Leah Ghali, wants to have you come to a meeting." That is how all this happened, in a very inscrutable way. It was all guided, supported, from behind the veil, a hand was moving. Our ability to get the truth to the right people all came about because the doors opened mysteriously. And this is how I knew that what I was doing was the right action. By 1991, I had decided that I needed to begin to train people in the experience of the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind initiative, the S-5 initiative. S-5 is when humans deliberately welcome and make contact with extraterrestrial people by using a set of protocols to vector them into an area to interact with them. That was the first project of XETI. Within a very short time I also wrote all the assessments of the situation. Those white papers were created very quickly. They immediately got picked up by people at the CIA and distributed throughout the aerospace industry. I had a top covert aerospace person call and say, "This is the most accurate assessment of the UFO and extraterrestrial issue we have ever read. It is the original paper and is in the first book, Extraterrestrial Contact, The Evidence and Implications." This aerospace scientist then asked me, "How do you know these things?" I said, "Well, that is a long discussion," so we had a long discuss, Cyan. In the winter of 1991, we decided to go to Belgium, where we had heard there were an enormous number of encounters with massive triangular-shaped craft. As you know, in 89, 90, 91, outside of Brussels, thousands of people had seen huge triangular UFOs and they had been filmed, photographed and tracked on radar. Well, at that time I really didn't train people for this. In my innocence, I thought that everyone could just sit down the first time and enter cosmic consciousness, bilocate into space, vector them in and be ready when a ship showed up. I soon learned that much preparation was needed. In the early days that is what we did. We just took a group of people over and we did it. The first group was me, my wife Emily and two others. We went out and we had the most extraordinary experiences. You can read about them in Extraterrestrial Contact, The Evidence and Implications. We ended up meeting some of the top people in Belgium who were working with the Belgium Air Force on this. We then went out to the areas where these huge craft had been seen. One area was near Eupen, which is in eastern Belgium, near the German border. While at a farm, suddenly a string of lights appeared. It was in an area where one of the gendarmes had seen a massive craft. But all we saw were what looked like a string of lights in a field. Of course, everyone said, "Those are just some lights on the farm." I knew they didn't look like normal lights. We sat there and we watched an object sitting in the field and suddenly the lights vanished. The next day we went back and discovered that there were no street lights, no wires, nothing in that whole area where the lights had been. It had been a craft sitting there. On another night we were near Henri Chapel, at the military cemetery on a ridge. It was a terrible night, raining, sleet mixed with rain. We stayed in the cars and did the S-5 meditation and vectoring. All of a sudden we heard a deep rumbling vibration. Imagine something that felt like the size of the Empire State Building, rumbling, humming like a transformer. It had a deep vibration. And suddenly, as we looked up in the cloud cover was only a couple of hundred feet above the ridge or less, something that looked like a full moon dipped down, and moved underneath the clouds. Emily saw it first, actually. It was a corner of one of these massive ships. Then it slipped back up. It just stayed there right on top of us, resonating, humming with a deep vibration. As this was occurring, I saw in my mind's eye the occupants of the ship. The energy vibration that we were feeling was because they were completely checking us out and connecting with the vehicle and with us as a group and individually. It was very close, close enough that you could feel it. In the course of this trip to Belgium, I learned that many of the people that had reported seeing these objects had had their stories sanitized by the mainstream UFO research groups. For example, I went back and met with some of the police who were in a small village where a massive ship the size of 3 football fields was hovering over a steeple. Part of their story was sanitized out of the report so that they wouldn't lose credibility. The way it disappeared was not that it glided off and then zoomed out into space like a movie from Hollywood. This huge triangular ship, 800 feet long on each side, hovering above the town square, suddenly collapsed into a pulsing red ball of light the size of a basketball. It moved a little bit and then vanished straight out into space, in the blink of an eye. Now, the reason I relate this is that many people will see an orb and they will think it is just an orb. But it could be an enormous half-mile-long craft that has changed energy forms, some would say dimensional shift, and appear as a ball of light. So having that experience taught me two things. First of all, the extraterrestrial capabilities are extremely advanced. But also, what is in the UFO literature has been largely sanitized, so the most salient aspects of the technology have been taken out, sometimes so that people won't be discredited because it is so unusual. But then, if it isn't very unusual, most of the time this means it is an alien reproduction vehicle that is being manufactured by Lockheed and Northrop. People often ask, how do you know the difference between a man-made UFO and an extraterrestrial vehicle? It's very obvious if you are ever close up to one, because the entire quality of it is different. The ones that are extraterrestrial are extremely advanced, in the sense that they are awake. The actual craft itself has artificial intelligence and is conscious. The beings on board are connected into it and can connect to you consciously. And the kind of light it gives off is like nothing you have ever seen on Earth. It is extraordinary. It looks like it is not of this world, and has an energy and intelligence associated with it that is very advanced. By 1991, I began to branch out and I appeared at a few conferences to present these concepts. My point was, these ET craft are here and they are under intelligent control, and these life forms are able to interact with us. If they know that there is a group of humans willing to do this for peaceful purposes rather than for military purposes, they will respond, if possible. One of my great concerns is that the relationship between humans and extraterrestrials has been hijacked by a military-oriented group that are mismanaging the relationship. They are not conscious about what they were dealing with. There is nothing written anywhere that says we have to cede that relationship to a group of people who have arrogated it to themselves, and who are ruining the embryonic relationship between ET worlds and humanity. The relationship between humans and extraterrestrials has been totally neglected because there is no formal program that is open and honest dealing with it in the State Department or the United Nations or from any other peaceful group. So, it became clear to me that we should reach out to the ETs. If we don't, a vacuum will continue to exist into which others intent on doing harm will step. Those approaching this issue from a purely military perspective or technological perspective can only do harm. To correct this dangerous situation is the purpose of XETI and the S5 initiative. We must create a peaceful rapprochement between humans and extraterrestrial beings and create a relationship that would redound to the benefit of all concerned, rather than to only a clandestine operation that would benefit a handful of people trying to commandeer the technology for their own selfish purposes. By 1992, we had found enough people interested in this that we started doing some larger expeditions. In March of 1992, I went to the Pensacola area and taught about 50 participants this protocol. The very first night I decided we should go to the state park beach. We were out there just a few minutes, and at around 8:30 p.m. an ET craft appeared. Initially there were 2 ET craft, and then there were 4 of these UFOs, shaped like globes with an amber, red light in the center of the bottom of the craft. They appeared to simply manifest in the sky near us. We started making a big triangular shape in the sky with very powerful searchlights. Suddenly, three of these UFOs made a perfect equilateral triangle in response. Then I would signal to them twice and they would signal back twice. I would signal once and they would signal once. But what was actually going on was that there was a conscious ET presence that was on the site. There was a non-visible and electronically projected consciousness of the occupants of these vehicles on site. A few other people sensed this and jumped in their vehicles and roared away. They were thinking, oh my god, this is actually for real. There were four separate cameras that filmed this, and there were also two former Air Force pilots who saw it, one of whom was connected to a UFO organization as the Eastern Director of Research. That organization would not let him write up this event and put it in their journal. It was sanitized out. This mass witnessed close encounter of the fifth kind was filmed and witnessed by everyone. The next day it was reported in the local paper with photographs of the UFOs. But then the UFO subculture itself, which traditionally has been controlled by the counterintelligence spook department, sanitized all of the reporting out of the literature. This was a real eye-opener to me about what was going on in the so-called UFO community. But we also learned that humans could come together, decide to contact ETs, and have an event take place, all in the framework of peace and cosmic awareness. At one point I remember someone saying, just who the hell do you think you are, going out there, basically bypassing the National Military Command to do this? They knew that we had discovered the Rosetta Stone of extraterrestrial contact. So I said, I am a denizen of Earth and I have every right to be doing this. Besides, my mother's family were some of the original founders of the United States. They fought in the American Revolution and were prisoners of war with the British. Beyond that, my father was half Native American. His ancestors were here waiting for you Europeans to get here. So we have every right to be doing this. I finally said, look, I know who you folks are, but I have had up close and personal contact with these extraterrestrial beings and their craft and their technology. You can't deceive me about what is going on. You can't fool me, number one. Number two, I am not rich, but I am wealthy enough as a physician that I don't need your damn money, so you can't bribe me. And number three, when I was 17, by any medical definition, I was dead. I had an enlightenment experience, so I am not afraid of death, and you can't frighten me away. I am going to do this one way or the other. There is nothing you can do about it. And I remember the look from the general. It was, we know exactly who this son of a bitch is. So here began the process of a covert group that was desperate to infiltrate us. What had been warned in 1990 had begun in earnest. The next month, in May of 1992, I had agreed to help convene a conference at the Street Mallows Retreat outside of Rocky Mountain National Park with astronaut Brian O'Leary and Maury Albertson, who was one of the co-founders of the Peace Corps, and the Institute for New Science. It was a private retreat and we invited everyone involved in the civilian UFO world. There were a number of other people who, of course, turned out to be intelligence operatives, including General T.E. and his friend the psychiatrist. I wanted to create a collegial environment where there could be a sharing of information and perspective. In reality, I found out that the whole UFO civilian world was rife with paid disinformation hacks and warring factions that within 2 nanoseconds of arriving at this facility had pulled out their knives and hatchets and were sinking them into everyone's back, including my own. That was when I learned what a snake pit the civilian UFO world really is. During the course of this retreat, the general and the psychiatrist were trying to court me into joining their group. The general said, you know, we have an organization that deals with this that is very private, a loaded word meaning super, covert. I knew what he was saying. Then he said, if you would just merge your operation with ours, we will give you as much money and as much power and access to technologies as you could ever dream. And I said, thanks, but no thanks. I don't need it. I thought I made that clear when we met in Atlanta last month. but he persisted in attempting to convince me, because they knew the kind of threat we could pose to their covert monopoly on the issue. They said as much. A good friend of the NSA guy that was there and another CIA guy came to me and said, "You know, they are very jealous of what you are doing because they are in a black box and can only do certain things for certain purposes. You are a free agent and you can do more than they can." I knew this. I explained, "We may not have temporal power but we are free, and have other powers that are God-given." Eventually, the general went to Emily, my wife, without me present. He told her about this group, but he didn't call it MJ-12. He said there was a board for this group. He said that this board had a certain number of seats on it. Interestingly, he said that the number was 9. Of course, he had done deep research into us and knew we were Bahus and our holy number is 9. So, he said there are 9 board members, each with his own shield, a certain crest, that would be given to me if I would simply take my organization and merge it with his. And Emily, being very sweet, said, "Oh, he seems so nice and he said all these wonderful flattering things about you." I said, "Yes, dear, but can't you see what they are trying to do?" Finally I went to them and I said, "Look, let me be clear. I am fiercely independent and I am going to keep this a private, clean operation with its intended purposes. There is no amount of cajoling and no amount of money or offers of power that will ever change that. By the way, General T.E. has been involved with these covert projects since he was a very young man. I confirm this through independent sources. He had been head of Army Intelligence before he retired. But he was just telling people that he was retired. They never retire, until they end up in a coffin. I met a military pilot who, in the 1960s, was in a special operation to pursue UFOs and film them. He told me that once a crew had such an encounter, they were split up and sent to various new posts, but that all the information went directly to a guy he was convinced I had never heard of, General T.E. When he told me this story I laughed and said I know him well. After rejecting these advances by the general, within 30 days the entire internet had websites set up and messages being sent out to the public attacking me. They unleashed all the dogs within the UFO civilian community, within the press, everywhere. I was called everything from occultist to a demonic communer with extraterrestrial sinister forces to a fraud. Then they released the lie that I wasn't a medical doctor. Here I am at the hospital and they have put out the that I am not even licensed to practice medicine. I have to then release to the public my medical license and degree to show that I am actually a medical doctor. The psychological warfare and harassment was intense, and continues to this day. For 14 years it has been a relentless string of attacks, character assassination, defamation of character, and every kind of dirty trick. General T.E. told me a number of things. For example, he said there were extraterrestrial craft and facilities underneath the surface of Mars and that covert projects had imaged them. He also privately told me about all kinds of assets that covert programs had that were advanced technologies, up to the level of what the ATs had. I was able to gather quite a bit of good information through the courtship that was being attempted. I learned that this particular cell was interfacing with the civilian UFO world from the covert world. They are an interface group and they have penetrated many civilian UFO projects. I knew then why that lawyer had told me in 1990 to be very independent, careful and very public. I had to be a lion at the gate to protect what we were doing from infiltration and from attempts to destroy it. There would be offers of enormous amounts of power and money, threats and attacks. I would have to be willing to be the kind of warrior that I had, in a sense, been trained to be through my childhood and early adult experiences. A media feeding frenzy? This caused some difficulty because a lot of the places where we wanted to set up our contact effort were being totally overrun with curiosity seekers and the media. I remember one time dashing through the countryside, trying to shake the cameras and media. It was like when Princess Di was being chased through the tunnel. We were speeding along trying to shake off a German TV crew who was following us so they could stake us out and see where we were going to be that evening. In July of 1992 we went to a farm in Alton Barnes, which was the epicenter of the most interesting crop circles. This was a large farm, over 1,000 acres, and we were given permission to use the property for this purpose. We set up a number of experiments over the course of the week or 10 days that we were there. One of these was to go up on Woodbury Hill and as a group visualize a specific shape of a crop circle. We began the meditative process, first expanding awareness, then connecting with the extraterrestrial people, and then asking them to create the specific shape that we were visualizing. We didn't decide what that shape would be until the night we actually sat together on Woodbury Hill. We decided that it should be what is now known as the Xeti Triangle, an equilateral triangle with a circle at each apex. As a group, we conveyed this precise shape into unbounded, universal mind, and to the ETs. The next morning, the exact shape we were sending out was discovered in a field not far from where we were working. No one except this relatively small group of people doing this knew the design. In fact, we didn't even know that this crop circle had appeared until a couple of days later, when we came across Ralph Noyes who said, "Oh, we just learned from a farmer that the most perfect crop circle of the season has been found. It is the most anomalous bending of the crop and unusual phenomenon in it, and has appeared on this farmer's land." The farmer had been out working in the field until very, very late the night before and went out very early, because it was a dry period, which is rare in that part of England. Nobody had been in the field, and it was hard to get to, being right at the base of Oliver's Castle, a steep cliff area surrounding the field. So I asked, "What shape is it?" And Mr. Noyes said, "Well, I've drawn it in my book." We bent down and looked at what Ralph Noyes had drawn. It was exactly the shape that we had projected the night of the experiment. Immediately, Shari Adamiak, my main assistant, and a couple of other Xeti team members dashed to this farm. We went up to Oliver's Castle, and looked down on the field, and it was as if the shape had been lifted from our minds and placed exactly in the field. We were stunned. Later we learned that some of the tests that were done on the actual crop and soil indicated that there were electromagnetic anomalies and cell wall changes in the plants. The tests indicated that this was one of the most important crop circles of that season, from a scientific point of view. Interestingly, a group of people who were studying crop circles and had been funded by W.B., the wealthy businessman, and some other people connected to covert programs, sanitized their report of this particular crop circle, and especially of how it was conceived. Here was the same pattern. The so-called civilian UFO community, riddled with spooks, had sanitized the Gulf Breeze event in March of that year, now had sanitized this one. This was another indication of how tightly controlled the so-called civilian UFO community is and how thoroughly it is infiltrated. One evening, while at the base of Woodbury Hill, we were doing our CE5 protocol and inviting the extraterrestrial vehicles to come into that area. Suddenly, in the clouds above us, there appeared counter-clockwise spinning lights, not coming from the Earth shining up like a searchlight, but from above the clouds shining down. There were a whole series of circular lights that were going around counterclockwise shining down from above into the clouds. Shortly after that, it suddenly started raining, very hard, but it was raining only on this very small area where we were doing our contact protocols. It seemed as if the ETs had created an artificial weather event to allow a major contact to occur, but in the privacy of a rainy, foggy night. Eventually, it was raining so hard that almost everyone left. Colin Andrews, who had been in another area of the farm, and a whole group of other people, left. Four of us moved to a narrow concrete road that was on the farm, just wide enough for one vehicle behind another. There was a little pull out on it where we decided to stay. Through my intuition, I knew that the ET craft would come. I was clearly told, "We will be there later, later." So I said, "Let's just stay here in our cars, and wait." It was after midnight. We decided that we would stay in two separate vehicles, and do the protocols from there. Then all of a sudden, I heard this banging on the window of the driver's side of the car, and it was Chris Mansell, the Englishman that was with us, from the car behind us. As I put the window down, he said, "There is a spacecraft rotating in the field and lit up like a bloody Christmas tree." And I said, "Yeah, yeah, and I'm Santa Claus." I felt sure he was joking. He said, "No, look," and as I looked out the window I saw a ship, about 100 feet in diameter, disc, shaped with a coned top with lights. Around the edge of the disc were beautiful multi-colored lights, red, green, blue, yellow, that were going around counter-clockwise. The craft was spinning counter-clockwise, but the lights were going that direction as well as clockwise, fusing and blending into each other, in a beautiful, very unusual pattern. These lights were like something not of this world. The intensity and the quality of the light was unlike anything anyone had ever seen. And it was so close. Initially it was a little higher above the field, but it came to within 10 feet above the ground, and in the same field where we were, just a few hundred feet away. We got out of the vehicle and went into contact and signaling mode. But the woman I was with was completely terrified. She came completely unhinged. I learned that, unfortunately, people really do need to be prepared for this kind of event. Her anxiety was in part because we were close enough to this huge craft that the compass we had was rotating with the craft counter-clockwise. The magnetic field was actually moving off magnetic north and moving around counterclockwise. The electromagnetic effects of the CT craft also caused her hair to be slightly electrified and standing on end. You could sense an unusual silence in the field and the presence of the consciousness of these beings who were on the craft. It was just astonishing. At this point I said, "Well, let's signal to the craft with the search lights." And as I signaled to the ship, it moved closer to us and signaled back. With that, this woman became quite hysterical, and screamed, "Oh, my God, don't do that. But this is why we're here," I exclaimed. "Well, I didn't think they would actually come," she said. "Well, then why did you come? Do you think this is a joke?" I asked. In her mind, she thought that maybe we would just have a sighting from far away. But it was a really close encounter with this craft, and she knew that they were there because we contacted them and she knew they were signaling with us. Chris Mansell and the Dutch woman who was with us were very calm and relaxed, excited, but not scared. But this one person was scared. And the moment that her fear really broke through, the craft stopped coming towards us and then backed slowly away. This was an act of compassion. Even though there was no threat at all from this craft, the ETs knew someone was afraid, and they gently and slowly backed off. Then, the ship began to rise slowly and went up into the mist and off into the clouds. As it did so, we could see that it was actually staying up in the clouds above us. We could still see its lights, but it appeared as a softly glowing amber object, floating silently. Amazingly, the compass we had continued to rotate counter-clockwise, the same way the craft rotated, until the needle on the compass made a complete 360-degree revolution all the way back to north. It was a beautifully choreographed encounter. At the end of that hour, the sky opened up and this object appeared again, but this time higher. As I signaled to it, it signaled back to us and then it vanished. And that is how that CE5 ended. As the event was unfolding, the rain had stopped to just a mist, and the whole area was enshrouded in clouds and fog. Colin Andrews told us, as soon as he got onto the road and left, it was dry. I believe the lights seen earlier that were spinning around in the clouds above the farm were setting up a weather change that allowed this event to take place in privacy. It turns out that the people who were attempting to spy on our expedition and disrupt the effort to make contact all left because they were discouraged by this terrible English weather. I realized from this experience that I really needed to better prepare people for contact. Participants would need to learn how to be more centered in consciousness so that they wouldn't be afraid, because it is an unusual experience, and there are unusual physiological and electromagnetic effects when you are fairly close to these objects. Being centered in calm, deep awareness is essential. The next day it turned out there were a few people who were on some of the surrounding hills who saw much of this encounter, so we had corroboration, and word got out. The next day, it was a feeding frenzy of media and public interest.